This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host on New Books Network. And today I am here with Wale Talabi, who is the author of Convergent Problems. Wale, thanks for being here with me today. So I'm wondering if you could start by talking a little bit about this collection, just giving sort of an overview of what the collection is about and what you have going on in the collection.
All right. Thank you very much, Rebecca. So the collection, as you mentioned, is called Convergence Problems. It is a collection of science fiction, fantasy, some slipstream, weird, not necessarily categorizable stories, but mostly speculative fiction in general. And there's kind of a running theme through the whole book, which I talk about in the introduction, that kind of ties all the stories together. And that is this theme of going through and overcoming, or at least encountering problems and challenges as we try to become better versions of ourselves. And mostly this is illustrated through the new versions of technology, some of which are extrapolated from real world technologies today. There's lots of stories. I would say 80% of the collection is about science fiction. So there's a very heavy focus on technology. But some of them are also just fantasy, especially urban fantasy, not much epic fantasy. I like urban fantasy because, again, it's closer to our reality. And some of those introduce a fantasy element that kind of show challenges, more focused on the personal and the character aspects. Family dynamics, interpersonal disconnections from our sense of self, sense of purpose. So I try to illustrate all those kinds of challenges, sometimes illustrating potential solutions and sometimes just, you know, doing what fiction does best by highlighting an aspect of our own life, existence, reality in a heightened way, right? Like kind of showing it through a different angle, a different point of view from the prism. Especially. And most of the collection also largely focuses on Nigeria or African characters. However, the themes I address, I think, are fairly global. I am a Nigerian, so Nigerian from Nigeria, born and raised, but I have lived outside Nigeria for the last 15, 18 years now, I think. And I think I like to bring that general global sensibility of what connects us as humans, what are our concerns, hopes, fears, and as we tend towards them, what are the challenges that we could potentially overcome, potentially encounter, and hopefully overcome.
So, you know what, you kind of alluded to one of my questions was that about, like, I love that. As I would read, I was like, okay, it is, you know, reminding myself, especially with like sort of science fiction and fantasy, like that there is very much this Nigerian, right? We're in this certain country, we're existing in this space, but it read in this way that I had to keep reminding myself where I was, because in fantasy, sometimes I, you know, you go to different worlds, but you kind of ground us in Nigeria, like in there's little bits or pieces throughout here that kind of bring us back to, yes, it might be like 2030 or it might be like, you know, 20, a different, you know, it might be well in the future, but we're still thinking about that future through that sort of lens of being in thinking about Nigeria. So was that something, do you do that in your fiction often? Was that a thoughtful thing? Can you talk a little bit about that? And because sometimes people, when they're writing science fiction or fantasy, bring us into another sort of a different world, right? And you kind of keep us in this world. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think it's definitely deliberate, but it's kind of deliberate in the sense that that is the kind of story I like, Right. And I write those kinds of stories. I love fantasy that can transport us to new worlds. But my favorite kind of fantasy is the kind that shows us a kind of twisted mirror version of our own, either by extrapolating, which is what science fiction does really well, imagining what a potential future could look like, or by just introducing a fantasy element, a non-real supernatural element, and treating it seriously as if it were a thing in the real world, kind of overlaying it on top of our real world. And I love that because it gives you this sense of what I really enjoy in a story, what I kind of call that estrangement and familiarity at the same time, right? Sometimes to use a culinary metaphor, they always say sometimes a dish is most interesting when the different elements that make up the dish have contrasting texture, contrasting taste profile, so sweet and sour, something crunchy and something soft right next to each other. And I kind of think it's a bit similar with fiction. Sometimes you put contrasting elements together, especially when something is both familiar and strange at the same time, I think really makes for interesting fiction. I also think if you go too much in either direction, the story loses a bit of its power. If it's too strange, then it's hard to follow, it's hard to connect. It's hard to feel like you're reading something that matters. It's more difficult to empathize. The writer has to do a lot more work to build a connection if it's too strange. If it's too familiar, then it's not interesting, right? It's just everyday life. So I love stories that can do both. And the way I work around that is by grounding it in what is familiar to me. And I mentioned I'm Nigerian, born and raised. I went to school in Nigeria. My parents were Nigerian. So I'm Nigerian through and through, you know. And Nigeria is a fascinating place all by itself. I sometimes joke that Nigeria is kind of it's a science fiction country because strange things happen all the time. It can be a bit unstable. Luckily, not politically anymore. It used to be when I was growing up, so sometimes that features in my stories as well. I have one story that literally talks about a political revolution. But it tends to be more unstable in just in terms of the structures in place. It's a country that's gone through a lot of turmoil over the years, but that also, for lack of a better word, also makes it interesting. So there's lots of elements I like to throw in there. And I also love to explore not just Nigerian specifically, but a lot of African history and philosophy and science and technology. And that I do very intentionally because, thanks in large part to colonization, a lot of traditional African philosophies, sciences, technologies were basically discarded. When the European colonists came, everything was kind of viewed as primitive without actually taking any time to understand, to analyze the worldview, because they came from a point of view where they thought these people they were encountering were less than them. So why would they take anything that we thought or the way we understood the world seriously? So a lot of that has been either lost or is just not there in public consciousness. And I personally love going back to dig up those elements of philosophy, traditional science, especially the philosophies, the core philosophies, and then taking them and infusing them with a more modern sensibility, a modern science fictional take on those same core philosophies, both to illustrate them for myself because I find them interesting, but also I would say in a way kind of to share them with the wider world as well, and let those be known that that sense of place, as well as that sense of history, philosophy, culture, is still rich and real and important. And I think it makes the stories just more interesting, in general.
So you bring up you're an engineer, correct? As well,
I am.
because I think often too, I would love for you to talk about sort of some of that research and digging up and right. So sometimes there's this idea that if I'm going to write fantasy or science fiction, that I'm just making things up, right? And fantasy gets that sort of a little more than science fiction. But could you talk a little bit more? I would love for you to talk a little bit more about that. Like, so the research, how being an engineer, how being a scientist kind of informs you as a writer and what you're writing and coming to this space from.
Yeah, I think I've probably said in a few interviews before, my engineering brain and my writing brain are the same brain. They are entangled with each other in a way that's impossible to separate. And that probably goes all the way back to my childhood, because my dad was an engineer and my mom studied English literature. So I think if you take the average of that, you end up with science fiction writer. But more seriously, though, I grew up in a house full of books, both science fiction books, non-fiction books, lots of books on science, technology, history, politics, culture, and also literature. Like I mentioned, my mom studied English literature, so we had a lot of those books in the house. So I grew up reading all of these things at the same time. And then I would have these long discussions with my dad, who I think could have been a science fiction writer if he wanted. But he was more just a fan and he used to read them and he had his whole collection. But we used to have these long discussions about elements of history. And we would look at parts of history, for example, you know, the Roman Empire or the Zulu, the rise of the Zulu Empire and Shaka Zulu and his methods. And we would always kind of frame it the same way. There's a story. But we would look at the technological aspects of it, right? Like what enabled that to happen. For example, Shaka Zulu came up with a new kind of weapon, right? The assegai, by re-engineering the traditional Zulu spear. And that enabled him and his warriors to fight a bit better. But there was always an element of philosophy. He had a different worldview from the other rulers living around the area. So we would discuss all these things and try to understand why. Why did this work? What happened? That's kind of framing and understanding was built into me long since I was a child by having these discussions with my dad, reading all these books. I was very curious about how the world works, but not just how, but also why the world works. And that the how is usually the engineering part, but the why is more of a philosophical question. And I like to say everything is philosophy in the end. And writing is a kind of meditation on memory, but also on imagination, especially if you're writing speculative fiction, right? If you're writing literary fiction, then it tends to be more of a meditation on memory. There's a lot of focus on detail and internal motivation. So you're very focused on the internal. And speculative fiction tends to be a meditation on imagination, on the possibility of what could happen or what could be different. Or sometimes you're doing both, right? Meditating on both memory and imagination at the same time. And I've kind of always done that. And what has basically happened is whenever I'm working on an engineering problem, I'm not just always thinking of the how, I'm thinking of the why. And whenever I'm writing a story, I'm not just thinking of the why, I'm thinking of the how. So I think that comes across in my stories because I try to explain a lot. Even when I'm making something up, I generally, in my mind, have some kind of framework around which this would be possible. It's usually based on extrapolation of some real-world technology, and I love doing research. I subscribe to all the major scientific journals. I love reading the new, latest research. Sometimes they directly inspire my stories. I think one of the stories in this collection, An Arc of Electric Skin, was directly inspired by an article in the Journal of Applied Chemistry, right? That was really fascinating about changing the conductivity of skin, or well, of melanin specifically, and then I extrapolated. So that's why it's called An Arc of Electric Skin. So that whole process of always thinking about not just why, but how at the same time is embedded into everything I do. At work and also in my writing. I think that means for people that have a bit of a structured way of thinking, they might tend to enjoy my stories more. But I think the stories are accessible to everyone because the one thing I never let get past me is that at the end of the day, the point of a story is to connect with the reader and to entertain. So as much as I love to explain things, I love to also put just enough to provide that sense of estrangement that I talked about, but also familiarity. I want the technology to feel strange, but I'm putting enough details that it feels like it could be familiar, right? It's related to some real world concept or idea that maybe you've seen on the news, or maybe you heard about in high school chemistry class or physics class, and you're like, well, that could be a thing. And if I can use that level of detail to produce familiarity while introducing estrangement, then I think I've achieved a level of making the work interesting. So I try for that in most of my science fiction.
So with this collection, you have there's about 14, I think, right? 12,
16,
for
16
16
stories.
stories in there. And so when you were putting this together, because you have author's notes in the back, so there's a, you know, we are not going to talk about all 16, but there's a couple I want to talk about. You can talk about more, but one of the ones I really loved was Saturday Song at the beginning. I loved it so much. And then when I read it, it sounds like it is part, like it was tied to some of the other, right? So when you put this collection together, we can talk about Saturday Song a bit, but also, were you really conscious in writing that you were going to put a collection together, or was this something that you started to see you had a, you know, a number of pieces that seemed to work together with this theme?
Yeah. So I will just say, first of all, Saturday Song seems to be really popular with people. It was actually just nominated for the Nebula Award, which was a big surprise because Nebula Award is one of the big two in science fiction and fantasy. So that's great. And lots of people have told me that they really enjoyed that story. So thank you, guys. And when I was putting the collection together, so essentially what happened is there is one story in the collection that kind of states the central thesis, if you will, of the entire collection. And that is kind of the story that the collection is structured around, both figuratively and literally, because it's the middle story and it's also the longest one. And that story is called Ganger. So Ganger is it's technically a novella, because it's about 30,000 words. So it's about 25, 30% of the entire book. And I started writing it last year. Actually, no, I started writing it a long time ago, but I really got into it and finished it early last year. And it was when I finished it that I kind of went back and looked at some of the other short stories I had written before that were unpublished and some that had been published and saw this the same kind of theme running through. Of explorations of traditional African culture, history, politics, philosophy, using a science fictional lens, and interrogating potential problems that could arise from modern key modern aspects of technology that we encounter today. So AI is a very big one, even bigger than I could have predicted when I started putting the collection together. Also space exploration, just general technology in general, automation, all of these concerns that have become much larger. So it was when I finished that novella that I realized that there was this theme running through a lot of the stories. And so I said, okay, let me see if I take some of these unpublished stories and some of the published ones and arrange them around Ganger to make some kind of thematic point. And see if it works. And I did, and it worked, I think. So then I sent it to the publisher, expecting a bit of a back and forth, like, okay, maybe we change this, maybe we change that. And they were like, nope, it's perfect, done. We're publishing it next year. Good. And I was like, oh, okay. That's awesome. And they took it exactly as I constructed it with all the stories exactly in the order that I had put them. So yeah, everything is kind of constructed around Ganger, which I think is it's interesting because Ganger is a story that I had the idea for a long time. In my author notes, I talk about it. A friend actually gave the idea to me as a birthday present. He just emailed me one day and he was like, here's your gift. It's an idea for a story. This happens, that happens, that happens. And then shenanigans ensue, right? So he gave me a premise, like a setup for a story about this girl living in a world where everything is provided for you. So a kind of post-scarcity situation where machines do all the work and people don't really have to do anything, but people crave, they crave purpose, right? There's this strong link between work and purpose. I wouldn't say work, but between doing something, right? Doesn't have to be paid labor in the capitalistic sense, but doing something meaningful in the world and a sense of purpose. And the whole idea is when that's taken away from you as a sense of utopia, people tend to crave wanting something. So he gave me the setup of this girl wanting to do something. His idea was she wanted to work in fields, be around nature, things like that. And she has to transfer her consciousness into a kind of, he put it as a robot, but they're more like automatons controlled by AI. And then he just said shenanigans ensue. So I was like, okay, this is a great setup, but I don't know what's the story, what's the core idea here. And it was only last year, end of 2022, early 2023, that the whole thing kind of came to me in a rush. And I wrote that whole novella in the space of, I don't know, a few weeks. It kind of just unspooled its way out of me. Actually, what came to me really was I saw the connection between that concept and an old traditional Nigerian legend of a hunter who basically becomes depressed when he can no longer hunt because he's too old, and he goes to seek this magical way to transfer his consciousness into the body of another animal. So I saw that parallel thematically between this hunter wanting to transfer his mind into the body of an animal so he could hunt, and this girl wanting to transfer her mind into the structure of an automaton so she could be free in this society. And then I merged the two stories together, and that's where the novella came from. And then after that, the rest of the collection was structured around it.
I will just say that is kind of incredible that you were able to send it off and just be told, okay, we're good. You did something right? Like, yeah. And one of the other things, could you talk about sort of that legend? I have a 13-year-old who is really obsessed with mythology in all different forms, right? And so one of the things that I did love was that we saw, I think that was like one of the things I appreciated, is that sort of ties to sort of story and sort of legend and myth come throughout this, and that it isn't that you don't, like, we don't have to have one without the other, right? We can have science and we can have technology, but we can also still believe in legend, right? We can also still believe in myth. And so I really appreciated that, seeing that throughout this collection and how that sort of appears.
Yes. So that's something it's kind of a personal worldview of mine, which is I'm not particularly religious, but I recognize certain things about human nature. One is we have always been religious as humans, and not religious in the sense of organized religion, but we have always had placeholders in our minds for the things we don't understand, right? So I like to term it as like faith is the boundary condition of knowledge, right? Because at the boundary of everything that we think we know and everything we think we understand, you must be choosing to believe something, even in the most scientific, you know, logical framework of thinking, faith is still the boundary condition. And as an engineer, I've seen this, right? I have two engineering degrees. I'm a very, very, like I mentioned, not particularly religious, but very structured, logical thinker. But at the end of the day, if you take, for example, any scientific theory, it is impossible to verify every scientific theory that you are going to apply, right? I today, when I go to school, I am taught certain foundational principles of science and experimentation and verification. And the foundation of what makes something scientific is that, you know, it is you're making observations and you're matching your belief to observations, right? You're matching some theory. You come up with a process to explain your observations. The reality is not every scientist in the world can verify every observation that they make, right? At some point, we are all, in order to move forward, you're going to take the word of other scientists. You're going to trust that other people have verified it 200, 300, 500 years ago. We are all operating on faith that other people have verified the foundations of our science so that we can now go forward, right? Sometimes we will go back and verify, but most of us don't. And even if you say, okay, that's one kind of faith, that's trust that other people have verified something, even though they're dead and we're just trusting whatever they wrote, you could also still say there's so many gaps in our knowledge, so many things we don't understand that we might understand in the future. But at the same time, it's a very reasonable thing to think that the more we find, the more we understand about the world, the more mysteries we also uncover, right? First, it began with classical physics, and it seemed like we were about to explain everything using a kind of simple classical physics approach to everything. And then suddenly we hit a new limit and realize, no, actually everything is quantum and it's all determined based on a kind of fundamental statistics, and nothing really has a fixed location or position. It's all just probabilities that collapse when you observe them. And that already sounds like magic. Now we can build a level of understanding around it, but there is a lot that we don't understand and we're still trying to understand about the world. And we will continue to search for that knowledge indefinitely. But I kind of think of it as that we will be asymptotically tending towards a final understanding, which means we will keep understanding more and more about the world, but we will never understand all. And that gap between understanding all and where we will end up is where we will always put space for the supernatural, for the fantastical, for myths, for legends, for whatever, because that's kind of, it's built into human nature. I sometimes like to say that we are meaning-making machines, right? Our brains are wired to constantly make meaning of the world, no matter what. You put a human in a situation, we will try to make meaning of it. And a big part of making meaning is story. We construct a story around what is happening, and we tell ourselves that story until it is true enough for us to believe it, to be motivated by it, to be inspired by it, to tell it to other people so that they construct a similar worldview so that we can work with them together. And this is, myths and legends are some of our oldest meaning-making devices. And that's why they've lasted so long, because they've structured the story around some fundamental observation about humanity that carries forward till today. Something about being brave, about the need having to be confident, about having respect for forces not larger than yourself, like, the oceans and the environment and all of these things. So some of those myths have a lot of power in them. Whether you believe they're real or not is kind of irrelevant. They occupy that space in the gap between what is knowable and what is unknowable. And they've made a story there. So they're really powerful. And I love to put that together because that's kind of the way we operate in the real world. We always have a certain level of things we understand and a large amount of things that we don't. And that doesn't stop us from functioning. We don't just freeze like some machine that has received an error code. It's like, I don't understand the world, I cannot proceed. No, you take all that uncertainty, you make meaning of it, and then you keep moving because that's what we are. So I think sometimes the classic Western philosophical approach of trying to very neatly draw a line between what's called natural philosophy or science, right? Very fundamental, based on observation and all of these things, versus the general philosophy, which is just trying to make meaning of the world, regardless of observations. This is where you would find everything from metaphysics to any kind of world philosophy you could come up with. And I think that line is more of a smear, right? It's not clean at all. There's a lot of interface between the two, and most of us occupy some space there. So I think to me, it's important to it feels realistic to incorporate that in the stories and to highlight it, especially as an engineer who is very intimately familiar with a lot of the details of the science and technology, but also the gaps where they are and where story can fill them up. And like I said before, I just think it makes things more interesting.
So yeah, one of the things, so I love that you have author's notes for every piece in the back. And so when I was looking and reading through your author's notes, one of the things you talked about is how you don't really like to write romance, or you don't really write romance, but you tried it twice in here. So can you talk, can you talk a little bit about that, like a sort of, I don't know if it's challenging yourself or it came along, but like go, like, you know, it kind of fits in with this kind of, there is like that uncertainty or doing something new or doing something different and writing, doing a couple romance pieces or
Right.
pieces that connect.
Yeah. So I think what we should have probably done is we should have had like a jar at the beginning of this call. And every time I say the word interesting, I should have given you a dollar because I'm going to use it again. I mostly love to experiment with all kinds of writing in every genre, in every possible way. You could tell story just because, again, I personally really find it interesting. And I think some of that is because I grew up with reading all kinds of stories. I read everything from, comics, graphic novels, adult literature, encyclopedias, official documents, textbooks, everything. I read a lot of it and I enjoyed a lot of it. Growing up. So to me, everything is story. This is why I say my writing brain and my engineering brain are hopelessly entangled and cannot be separated. Because to me, everything is story, but everything is also engineering. So one of the things I love to do is not just to think about what happens in a story and the kind of technology that would enable it or whatever, but I also love thinking about how do you tell this story? Right, like where do you approach the story from? Because a story is not just a story. A story is essentially a way of making meaning of a sequence of events. And depending on how you arrange the events in the order, you can make completely different meaning out of it. If you start the story from the end and then go back to the beginning, or if you start in the middle and then go back to the beginning and then jump back to the end. If you start it from this character's point of view or from another character's point of view, it could completely change the received meaning from the reader. And that process fascinates me. So it's something I love. It's something I love to think about and explore, like the overall structure of story. What Kurt Vonnegut referred to as the shape of a story. And he actually, I think it was part of his rejected master's thesis, proposed an idea that you could actually draw out stories as a graph, with points going up and down, depending on what's happening to the main characters. And you just know that that appealed to my engineering slash writer brain immediately. You're drawing a graph of a story. That's amazing, right? But it is there that stories can have different shapes, and the shape of the story gives a different meaning. So I love thinking about that and then choosing how to approach a story to tell it. So what you probably find is there might be certain genres that I don't naturally gravitate towards, but I am still fascinated by why they work, what attracts people to them. And sometimes I will still read them anyway. They might not be my favorite, but I will still read them and potentially be impressed by them. And then when that happens, sometimes I'm curious if I can construct a story that provides a different meaning or a different impact in a different way. So what you probably find is in convergence problems, there are two stories that are essentially romance or love stories, but they are also structurally experimental. And not crazy experimental as in impossible to read, but just structurally experimental in the sense that one of them, Silence, for example, is told from a second person point of view with no scene breaks. But the end of each sentence, the end of each paragraph is the beginning of the next one. And I wanted to see if I could make that structure work by like linking every character directly to the next one at the level of sentence. So the end of each paragraph is kind of an incomplete sentence that begins the next sentence in the following paragraph. So that structurally was interesting to me, and of course appeals to the engineering part of my brain. I'm engineering the story. And I do this with lots of different kinds of stories as well. I love to play with form and format and structure. I think convergence problems, I do this a lot. Alternating points of view, different types of story formats. One of the stories is formatted as a patent application memo with comments. And actually, by reading the memo and the comments, you get the story out. Another one of them is formatted as a blog post with comments. And in the comments, kind of, you get the epilogue of the story of what actually happens. Another one of them is structured similar to the love story I talked about, which is called Silence, where I have links between the paragraphs, but the links also link to a kind of Christmas carol because I wrote it as part of a Christmas thing. So I just love to play around with that, because it makes things interesting.
I have to say that you just brought up the other two pieces that I was really drawn to in your piece, right? Like in your collection. So, and I'd said this to you before we started talking, but comments on your provisional patent application for an eternal spirit core. Like what I loved about, right? Like, so yeah, I had to pull it up so I could do the whole, I'm like the one with the long time, but I really love because it got at like all these elements of technology in this kind of short way. Like, when your character who's reading the patents, like, I know you're online, right? I know you're reading this. You can't do this, right? To their sibling going back and forth, right? So you kind of see how we interact in real time. Like often I sometimes will be working with students and they'll pop on Google when I'm commenting on their work on Google. And so I appreciated that way in which you were, you know, playing with that. So I really loved how you thought about or played with genre with that piece.
Yeah, thank you. That was a fun one to write. And like I said, it's a long title that I'm pretty sure no one except me can recall without checking. But it is pretty descriptive of what happens. And there's a lot of stuff like that in the entire collection. I think it's also another way of structurally introducing a bit of familiarity and estrangement. I think for me, a lot of what attracts me to stories is that push-pull between the two. If the writer can give me a bit of estrangement to make it feel like I'm experiencing something different and new and fascinating, and then enough familiarity to be like, oh, I know what this is. This is familiar. And then take it away, and then bring it back, and then take it away. So as you're going through that, you're getting this process of familiar, strange, familiar, strange, familiar, strange, all the way. It kind of keeps you. It gives a kind of structural tension to the story that can carry through. I enjoy it when that happens, so I try for it, not just in the plots of the stories, but also in their structure. And that was an interesting one to write because I basically wrote it after filling out an actual patent application memo because I do have two patents for inventions I was co-inventor on. The first one was with my dad, who has passed away now. But we kind of invented a different method of producing cement that was supposed to be less energy intensive. It's never actually gone to production, but we kind of devised the method, proposal. It was the last thing we did together before he died. So I'm really kind of proud of that and happy about it, even though the technology has never actually been built, still a prototype. But then the second one is the one that I had just filled when I wrote this story. And that was for something more digital, as for an online digital engineering solution. And when I was filling the memo, I just kept thinking, it's a bit funny the way you fill out, because they give you a sequence of questions you're supposed to answer. And then the lawyers take that memo and then fill out a patent application form. So I was just going through, it felt like I was having a dialogue with the lawyer. Like they ask you a question, you need to answer. They ask you a question, you need to answer. And once I saw that element of dialogue, like once it hit me, then I thought, oh, could I actually make a story out of this? And then around the same time, I had read another story by an extremely talented Zambian author named Namwali Serpo. And she had published a story. I do not remember the title, but it was basically a story that was told, and it's just a list of receipts. So it's receipts from a woman's life as she goes through her day. And by seeing what she's purchased, you can actually get a really strong sense of what is happening in her life on that day. And it's basically a story. It's just a list of receipts. And I found that really fascinating because I've talked about us as meaning-making machines, right? You get a list of receipts and we make a meaning out of it. So actually the reader was constructing story. So I thought reading this patent application memo, there's an element of dialogue already. Could I take something like that and build a story out of it? And yes, I did because it gave me an avenue to also explore the thing I had done with my dad, which was actually, inventing this technology and getting a patent for it. And the story is literally about a young scientist engineer who's trying to build a technology or has devised a technology and is filing a patent for it. But the point of this technology is to be able to allow him communicate with his dead parents. And his other sibling, who is also an engineer, is kind of reading through this co the comments and realizing what his brother has done and is like, oh, this could be problematic. And in a sense, that's me exploring the aspect of myself that would like to have my parents back if the technology existed, which sometimes it feels like it could with Neuralink and all of these things that we have about, large scale memory storage. But then there's also the part of me that realizes that death is one of the things that makes us essentially human. And so that's not something, if you try to bring people back using technology, is it even really them? And what is the real objective of doing that? So in a sense, the story is me arguing with myself, but it's very strongly linked to my memory of my dad, who I had actually, my previous invention, we had worked on together.
So I'm going to ask you about one more because we could talk about many of them, but and I'm going to probably botch the title. But Abeokuta 52, which I love how you also play. Can you talk a bit about that and how you kind of played with genre? And I mean, I just love how you've done it and even have like the comment section in the forum. So yeah, can you talk about that one?
Yeah, so the pronunciation is actually Abeokuta. Yeah, but it's okay. But you did a pretty good job. You're close. So it's Abeokuta 52, and Abeokuta is the capital of my home state back in Nigeria, which is Ogun State. And for that story, I structured it as basically a blog post by this social activist whose parents have, or well, whose mother died when an alien, not a spacecraft, but an alien, let's say alien artifact crash lands in Abeokuta. And no one knows where it's come from or anything, but the government, takes it, strips it apart, finds all this, technology that they basically stripped down and used to build a new kind of technological market, right? And so my in the idea, the background of the story, Nigeria has become very successful because of all this technology that they've basically gotten access to by accident, or by fortunate accident. And this character is a social activist whose mother was one of the first scientists to investigate what the object was. And she has died as a result of it. So he's writing a blog post about what happened, what it meant for him and his family. And in the comments, he says at the end of the post, it's implied that he's coming to Nigeria to attend a live protest. And then in the comments, we find out what really happens to him because people are commenting on the blog post and they're kind of saying, back and forth, like any other comment section you would have. Some people are just saying nonsense. Some people are saying profanity and it has to be removed by a moderator. So I structure it that way to kind of reveal the story. And the reason I did that was, one, I thought it was interesting, but two, I think it also mirrors a lot of our real world experience of how many people read, because a lot of people do just read online a lot. Sometimes people tell me, oh, Nigerians don't read books. And then but they never say the last part. They say, oh, Nigerians don't read. Or they say young people don't read. And I actually think people read a lot more today than they used to before. They just read online. A lot of people read a lot of things online. They read blog posts, they read articles, they read Instagram posts, they read Facebook posts. They read a lot of stuff because, as much as I love books and I grew up around books, there can be accessibility issues around them, especially in Nigeria. Books are hard to come by. So that's the first part. I wanted to write in a story in a format that was familiar to a modern audience of readers, right? The blog post with comments, because you would read the blog and the comments. And sometimes the comments are more interesting, right, than the actual post itself. So that's a very modern way of reading and engaging. So I wanted to use that structure. And then the second thing the second reason I structured it that way was because I think I actually got my start writing on blogs. At least the root of my current writing phase was on blogs. I was writing on my own personal blog just after my parents died. I was using writing as kind of a way to explore my feelings and thoughts about what had happened, because they both passed away in the same year. So I was using writing as a way to explore all that. It was a difficult time. And then I met a group of other Nigerian bloggers and writers who were writing online as well. And we kind of formed almost this network or group, who would write posts for each other's blogs or comment on each other's blogs. And that whole process of writing and reading blogs was very formative to my writing process. It's kind of how I learned to write. And for years, I became editor for one of the blogs later on, one of the more popular ones in Nigeria. But it's a form I'm very familiar with, and I understand the feeling and emotion that you can actually convey from reading a post and then reading and engaging with the comments, right? Because sometimes you read a post, you're like, I'm not sure how I feel about this. I'm not sure exactly what happened. Then you read the first five comments and you're like, ooh. And then you read the next five comments, they're like, ah. And then you read another five comments, and you're like, they're responding to the previous comments, and you're like, I see what's going on here. So I wanted to kind of get that same sense in the story. And there is a plot twist. Basically, the plot twist to the story happens in the comment section. And that's something I really wanted to pass across and give that a fun but thoughtful reading experience to the reader.
Yeah, and I did love that because the plot twist does happen in the comments, right? And sometimes it's like you start and you're like, okay, I've got to let the comments go for a while and come back to them so I can get I can get everything that's going on. So there was a lot of that. So we've been talking a while. Do you want to read from one of your stories? Read a little bit for the audience so they can kind of get an idea about.
Sure, I will do that. And since you said it was one of your favorites, I will read, I guess, just the opening section of Saturday's song. All right, so before I start, I'll give a little bit of context. So Saturday's song, the framing device around this story is that there exists these supernatural entities that are embodiments of the concept of time. And each of them represents the day, a separate day of the week. And what they do is they tell each other stories, but these stories are all things that have actually happened, right? They're basically chronicling the lives of humanity. And the whole idea is, as they tell the story is happening. So they are supernatural beings, but I wanted them to be kind of involved in the story and use them to tell a larger story as well. So it's basically a story within a story. And I'll read the opening framing of Saturday's song. The seven siblings sit in a place beyond the boundaries of space and time, where everything is made of stories, even them, especially them. People are made of stories too, but only the versions of the stories that they tell themselves, curated, limited, incomplete. Many of the stories people tell themselves are lies, layered on partially perceived things to give their lives structure and meaning. The siblings who sit beyond sit true, for they are made of all the stories that were, that are to come. They tell each other these stories, taking them out and examining them in the light, like a never-ending self-dissection. They listen to the stories, and as they do, they are made whole again. They exist in narrative equilibrium, in constant flux. They tell each other stories of what has happened, is happening, will happen, because it is their function. They tell these stories because they must. Sometimes they sing the stories too. Saturday likes to sing. She thinks she has a nice voice. And this is true. It's euphonic, lilting, mellow but strong, and full of emotion. So her siblings let her sing her parts of the stories when she wants to. Some stories demand melody. Let us tell another story, Sunday says, breathing the words out more than speaking them. He is the most knowledgeable of the seven siblings, even though none of them know why. He just is, because that is his story. He rakes the tight curls of his beard with his fingers before continuing. Saturday, it's your turn to choose a story for us to tell and hear. Saturday stops playing with the thick, long braids of her gold-spun hair. She is still surprised, even though she knew it was already her turn before he told her so. She looks around the table, avoiding her sibling's stares, and then she closes her eyes and focuses inward, seeking out the story she knows has a good shape, the story that feels right, like she's reading her own bones. When she finds it, the story she knows they need in this moment of non-time, she beams a smile and radiates the choice out to her siblings, passing the story they all know she has chosen for them to hear and tell. None of them react when they receive it, but they know it's a good story. Monday, who always starts the stories, begins his duty solemnly with clear words. Saura met Mobola at a financial management conference in... Stop! Saturday cries, holding up a small hand. The shock of the interruption leaves Monday's mouth open, like he's a fish removed from water. Sunday's emerald eyes widen. Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday crane their necks towards her. Their gaze is curious and hard. Only Wednesday does not visibly react, because she's bound up in thick, clanking chains. Punishment for the crime of trying to change a story. The time stone Wednesday used to perform the abomination sits at the center of the mahogany table, between two ornate pewter candelabra, like an offering or a temptation. Its emerald edges reflect and refract the candlelight in peculiar ways, making the bright orange light dance with shadows across the table and the walls. Saturday feels sad for her sister, but she knows she needs to be careful. She does not want to be punished too. Interruptions once a story has begun are mostly forbidden, although not as forbidding as attempting to change a story. The rules that govern the seven are both rigid and flexible, to varying degrees, like the rules of storytelling itself. Still, Saturday knows it's important it be done this way, for Wednesday's sake, for all their sakes. She says, "Forgive me, but I want to begin the story near the middle. Please, can we? We will go back to the beginning. But if we start at the middle, it makes the story so much better." She pauses her story choice again. This time she radiates not only its substance, but she also gives them its form and structure, the shape of it with all its contours defined. Not just what it is, but also the way she wants them to tell and hear it. They receive it as a stream of visions, a kaleidoscope of images, a swirl of sounds, a spectrum of sensations, a babble of narrator voices, as points of view, as music, as song. Sunday gives her a look that's both surprised and curious. Tuesday claps her hands with glee. Monday nods with understanding. He looks to Wednesday, the chains wound around her body like perforated metal anacondas. The chains are older than time itself. Saturday wants her shackled sister to tell the part of the story where Saura obtains the chains to bind the Yoruba nightmare god, Shigidi. For resonance, she thinks it gives the middle of the story the reinforcement it needs, like a good skeleton. Everyone has been allocated their part of the story to undergird it with what is important for the telling and the hearing. The other siblings also nod their approval, and this makes Saturday smile. They understand, even if they don't fully know her motives, but they know it is not just important to tell and hear the story. It is important to tell and to hear it well.
Thank you. So I'm going to, my final question to you. So the book came out about a month, little over a month ago, right? Middle of February.
Yep.
So anything new you're working on? Anything with this book? Like shout out to whatever you, however you want to like, you know, give yourself some, yeah, free publicity.
Yeah, of course. So I will, first of all, I'll take the opportunity because it's kind of mentioned at the end of that reading, I mentioned the Yoruba nightmare god Shigidi, which is actually a character from my novel that came out last year, in August of last year. So that's still out. It just came out in the UK in February as well. So for anyone listening, you can go grab Shigidi. It is also nominated for the Nebula Award for Best Novel this year, and was also nominated for the British Science Fiction Association Award for Best Novel, which was a shock to me. But that story, Saturday's Song, ties in to my novel. It kind of provides some background motivation, not essential, but enriching to the novel story to kind of illustrate some of the things that motivate Shigidi to do what he does in the novel. So if you read Saturday's Song and you read Shigidi's novel, they will enrich each other's experience. So you might as well get both books. Right now, what am I working on? I just finished writing a novella set in what we are fondly calling the Southiverse. I can, it's Southi, S-A-U-U-T-I. If you just Google Southi or go to southi.com, you'll see what it is. It is a shared world that I helped build with a group of other African authors. And it's this shared world that we're all writing stories set in. We published an anthology last year of stories set in this world. And we are working on another anthology. Some members of the collective have written novels set in this world already. And I just finished writing a novella set there as well. So coming soon. I have a bunch of short stories coming out in different anthologies. But my main project right now is I'm working on my second novel, which is a science fiction novel that I've been working on for some time, and I'm trying to wrap that up. And once that is done, I plan to return to Shigidi, Shigidi and the Brass Head of Obalufon, which was my first novel. And I have a sequel mapped out already. So I'm going to return to that once I'm done with the science fiction novel. So yeah, that's what I'm working on.
Wonderful. Thank you again, Wale Talebi, for talking with me about convergence problems for New Books Network. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.